This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 170, written by Space Ostriches. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Larry Nemechek. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Simon Pegg and the next Star Trek film script, and the possibility of a TNG reunion on screen. Then in the feature, we're joined by Norm Lau to discuss the original series episode, The Tholian Web. So let's step into The Ready Room. Hello, Larry. It's great to have you back here with me on The Ready Room. It's been a little while since we recorded anything together, thanks to the whirlwind of my life these days. And I understand that you've had a whirlwind week yourself.
I'm sorry. Who are you again? What? Oh, that is you, Chris.
So long.
I didn't recognize you from
right?
the beard and the dark. Okay. Wow. Yeah. It has been a while.
Well, I'm wearing my Tholian Web space helmet, so it's kind of hard for you to see my face clearly.
You're really getting in the mood for later on. Yeah, well, that's what it is. I've got my silver-painted sheer hose helmet, helmet on here, and I'm looking at you through that image. So let me take that off and make sure I've got the right helmet with my little name on the plaque here. Okay, I'm good. Yeah, no, it's been great. It's great to be back on the mic here with you. It seemed like these Sunday nights have been so lonely the last couple of months, but...
I'm very sorry, Larry. I've been leaving you to find your own things to do on Sunday nights.
So. If only I could have some more. Oh yeah, wait. I have been. Yeah, it's gotten a little crazy. No, thanks, Chris. It's my life has been getting full too, and we're swinging into con season and Enterprise in Space, and I'm working on my voiceover, and life's fun.
All right. Well, in the midst of all that, have you had time to keep up with the first news story we're going to talk about? Which is the fact that Simon Pegg, Scotty from the JJ films, is going to co-write the next film now that Roberto Orci is out of the picture. Apparently, we're going to be getting a movie in 2016, but they're just now, you know, finalizing who's going to write it and starting on a new script. So what do you think about Simon Pegg co-writing this?
Well, I'm totally up with it. Of course, he's a co-writer. I think he's there to have a touch with people who have been through the mill. First, he's a fan before he was ever playing Scotty in the Abrams verse.
Right.
It was really kind of amazing. The established meme of the whole layout of what the third Star Trek movie in the JJ verse was going to be just was totally turned on its head when we had that whole quick succession of Bob Orci is out, and oh my God, what's going to happen now? And he's not directing, but he might still be writing in his script and the compatriots he had and supervising. And no, it's going to be the new director. And how it was, these things have come out through leaks and the brother of the writer putting it on his Facebook page or whatever, and people picking it up in slow motion.
Yeah.
And then Simon being attached to it. So it's still a Bad Robot production. You know, on some hands, it's not like it's been thrown out to pasture. It's not this wild open, crazy grease pig contest here to see where the next movie's going to go. It's still under some wraps. We just had some different names, but some totally different names. Simon Pegg's, you know, written his comedy movies. He's had some, some real pathos in some of those moments. he's written a lot of, people don't know his UK career. I was just checking here that he'd written, you know, several dozen episodes of sketch shows and comedy shows. And if they're anything like a lot of, going back to Python, that I know of at least, much less American comedy, there's a lot of dramatic moments in good comedy. So
I'm just picturing now, come on the screen, and it says, and now for something completely different, a pink Enterprise.
A pink Enterprise.
Shoom, flies right by you.
With blood smears all over it and something, I don't know. But no, I, you know, it's like it's just a loose, there's a piece of me that goes, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do. But I don't think it's quite that loosey-goosey. And, you know, just to kind of backtrack a tad, I was actually one of the people who was quasi-excited to see what Bob Orsi was going to do with the show.
Yeah, once, and I was too. Yeah,
from the standpoint of being head writer and director and not being subservient as a writer and just on the production team and knowing that he was the most dyed-in-the-wool original and next-gen fan of that, of the Supreme Court, you know, of Bad Robots people involved. But having said that, and, you know, I can differentiate. I know how much gray area happens in between, even between friends are collaborating on something and colleagues, that what happens and who's really in the driver's seat versus who's riding shotgun and who's right behind the driver. So, but that's all, you know, that's a flash in the pan now. That's water under the bridge. So I'm, it's going to be what it is. And I'm not pulling my hair out over it. He's a mature guy and a mature writer and known for his comedy, but you know, he's part of a team too. So we'll see. I'm not jumping off a cliff. there's a piece of me that wants to say, you know, it's just the third new Star Trek Alternate Universe movie. It's not like we should all go jump off a cliff over it. But then I've been around the block. I've been around the sector a couple of times. So,
well, I wonder if it's going to take a comedic twist, because Scotty in the Abramsverse films has certainly been more comedic than Scotty in the original series films.
Yes.
One reason I have some confidence in this is because, like any good interstellar hitchhiker, as we know from the 2009 film, Scotty always knows where his towel is.
Right. Right, yeah. Although, didn't you think they tried to make an effort to not have Scotty be quite as comedic in Stid? I'm sorry, in Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah, I do. I think.
Yeah, they. In fact, he Scotty went from being a comedian to like a long distance runner,
right?
who didn't know what transporters and Jeffrey's tubes were. But
you know, another question that I had for you is, knowing that Simon Pegg's a Star Trek fan before actually being in Star Trek, do you think that in his writing we might see a return to it being Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, as opposed to Kirk, Spock, and Uhura in this, this incarnation of Star Trek?
That's actually a blog topic that I took on when you started seeing things like the billboards or the international spots that were being done, and it would, here would be the Kirk one, here would be the Spock one, and here would be the Uhura one. And it's just the fact that the marketers aren't caring about Kirk, Spock, McCoy, or even Scotty, because that's just more white guys. I mean, they were really looking at ethnic diversity and women, and they're totally looking at it as a marketing tool, and what they knew to be best practice to emphasize. Whether or not the script reflected that or not, that's what the marketing was going to be. And you know, and then of course a lot of people thought McCoy was underserved, and Carl Urban was underserved in that film anyway. So if nothing else, I hope Doug Jung and Simon Pegg get back to the triad, and you know, but who knows what they'll do. It's really interesting. I think, you know, movies even more so than series tends to be season to season, where people come up for air, especially when you're doing 26 stupid shows a year. You come up for air and go, okay, now what was working, what wasn't working. And a movie, you really have time, especially when you let 3 and even 4 years go by, you really got time to go, okay, what worked, what didn't work, what were people screaming about, what did they like, what did the critics like, what did the fans like or not like, do we care, do we pay attention, does it make sense, does it not make sense, you know, and going through that, not to make everything into a laundry list, and sometimes if you don't handle it right, it becomes a laundry list. And it's almost like Stid started off as a laundry list. It's almost like we're going to take the first one that most people seem to like and add here a little bit to it. But it turned into a completely different animal in a lot of ways. So, again, they're back to, you know, the Orsi script went down one path. I'm sure eventually we'll hear what that was and that will get out. And we know what he was saying about it all up until the time it changed over. So we'll see. I hope there's not a complete laundry list, although you know the international box office was up, but the domestic was down on the second movie. So there's a lot of things. And it appears that with JJ not being the driver here, Bad Robot still has the contract. They're doing the movie. But with him over in Warsland, Paramount, the studio, seems to be, with these changes especially, seems to be maybe staking a little more active role. You know, it's not like, okay, Wonder Boys, go off and do your magic thing. It's like, okay, well, we had these issues. We did the wonderful Literary Treks episode about Michael Piller's book, Fade In.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a scene we talk about on there where they did the first test screening of Insurrection before they did some of the reshoots and they pumped up the ending. But there's a wonderful way Michael talks about the scene where, of course, Sherry Lansing was head of Paramount. And up until that point, it had been Rick and Mike and the actors going around and a little bit of studio notes, but they pretty much said, here, guys, First Contact was a hit, do your thing. And it was still went around in circles way more than you think about it, but the studio people were kind of hands-off. But when the test screening came down, Michael, his prose narrative description about he got up, the lights came up, he looked around, and Sherry Lansing and all the Paramount execs had this kind of quasi-grim, determined look on their face. And it's like she left the room with everybody, not to like to shoot them or like beat them up, but it's kind of like, okay, we have some work to do. Just very executive stands up and wants his team or her team to follow behind because we have an appointment with the briefing room. We have a little staff meeting we got to go through right now. And you almost get the idea that corporately that's what Paramount was. That's the image I have in
Feels
all this
like
upheaval.
It. Yeah.
It's like whoever it was, it's like, we need to go have a talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the way things, it's like, we're going to jump in here and get a little more involved with things. So
it does feel like it, like when they saw the script. I mean, the story that I was hearing about with regard to time travel and Shatner and Nimoy being in there playing the older versions.
Assuming that we can take all those reports and leaks and whatevers as, you know, and they weren't out of context and whatever. Yeah.
It seems like someone said, okay, yeah, this is not the direction we want to go in here.
And I have no doubt that they were trying to get Shatner in because it's the third movie. It seems like a crime.
Sure.
You're lucky to still have him here and blowing and going as well as he is. And I think there was even an element of that was some of the, I think that was almost like, you know, when you have American or you have a foreign country's internal politics and they do something that plays out on the international scene and somebody goes, this isn't really about what they think of the U.S. or China or anybody. This is really for his domestic faction of the population over here. And I get the idea that the whole thing with the Shatner scene was a pitch to fans, but I almost feel like it was maybe trying to shore up maybe what was an eroding support base within the studio, you know? Maybe if I can get a wave behind this idea. And there was a lot of talk in the fanosphere, you know, about it, but I don't know that it really caught on. So I don't, you know, who knows? We'll know this eventually. Yeah. We'll know it eventually.
All right. Well, it'll be interesting to see where they go with it. As you mentioned in one of your comments there, Doug Young, creator of Dark Blue on TNT, is Simon Pegg's co-writer. So there could be a good balance there of, you know, Simon Pegg's comedic side with Doug Young.
Right,
and of course, we have Justin Lin directing. So, you know, it may create the kind of balance that's necessary to create a really good story.
Right. And people jumping on Justin Lin and saying, oh, he's a Fast and Furious director. Well, he's done a lot of pieces. And some say that his Fast and Furious films were a much more mature variety in that brand than the earlier films were.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, and I was talking recently with Rob Burnett about Justin Lin, and he's really excited about him directing this and pointed out the sort of family element of the Fast and Furious 6 and how that plays into the Star Trek family element as well. And he felt that Lin is a great choice for directing. So,
and the other thing unspoken here is when it will be set. Like what? Because people keep forgetting that the first two movies we saw they're set 10 years. People keep trying to compare the original series and the movies and all that, but they were 10 years in age ahead of when we first saw Kirk, when we first saw Where No Man's Gone Before and Corbomite Maneuver. They're 10 years younger than those characters are, alternate universe or not. So where they place them, are they into the middle of a 5-year mission? You know, already whatever they do. What the maturity and what the routinedness that's interrupted by some cataclysmic movie plot, you know, whatever they, however they set it and the time frame of the characters' ages will be interesting too.
Yeah, and that could differ, definitely. Yeah,
alternate universe or not, so we'll see. They ain't cadets anymore, or like one hop out of being cadets anymore, so.
Which would be a good thing.
Hopefully, yeah.
For me, yes. Anyway. All right, well, one other thing that fans got a little bit excited about recently. And again, just like our story with Simon Pegg, these are not necessarily timely news stories we're talking about here. They're just things that I really wanted to get your thoughts on since you're here with me today. This one relates to Patrick Stewart, who was doing a Facebook chat hosted by Entertainment Weekly about a week or two ago. And they asked him, of course, would you play Captain Picard again? And his response was, absolutely, if it were a really good script, but the poor soul is getting old and long in the tooth, he would probably need some help mounting his horse, unlike the youthful captain of 30 years ago. So,
really?
And then he also mentioned...
He said that? People got excited? I can't believe it. No, I'm kidding. No, of course you should get excited.
And then I've seen fans talking about, you know, maybe the Next Generation will come back. Maybe they'll do another movie or they'll do a special or something. And I really can't see, even if Patrick Stewart were to say, okay, I'll do Picard again, I don't know, I can't see everyone coming back, nor am I sure that I would want to see that, because I feel like the Next Generation, you know, they ran their course, they had their run, and that chapter of Star Trek for me, which I love, had a completion to it, and now we've moved on to other things. Now, you, of course, are very well known for your book, The TNG Companion. So in your capacity, having covered TNG so thoroughly, would you want to see TNG reunite?
Well, number one, I think it could totally be done. Well, that's the thing. Patrick saying that after all these actors, and especially Patrick, go through moods and swings, and they're all human beings. And they're all people who, like all of us, at different times in our life, we look at our current situation, we look at the past through different filters. You know, we view things differently at different phases of our life. And for the last, you know, especially after, I mean, Patrick's a Shakespearean actor. He's knighted. He didn't have to, there wasn't a lot more he had to do. And especially after he had Professor X in the other genre movie there that he was known for. It wasn't just, oh, he was Picard, and I hear he did some Shakespeare stuff. I mean, you know, he knows, and the Shakespeare fan base, you know, the fans of British, really great British actors, were totally up with all that. But now that even on the popular front here, he's got another franchise character, and I don't know. I think it's just you see all the Twitter, you know, the Instagram and the Twitter pictures of he and Ian McKellen, you know, just goofing around doing their show, yeah, during their Waiting for Godot, and just having a ball. And it's really kind of a who the hell cares, you know. I think the current mindset, I think the fact he's being self-deprecating there about an old man, but the fact that he's maybe partly kidding, but then serious too. He's not being serious and saying, oh no, we've run our time. Give it a rest, people. Enjoy the old shows. It was good to me. But the fact that he would say that even halfway in jest is cool. Now, nothing should ever be done just to be doing it. That's how some of the worst, you know, worst crapola ever. Okay, we've got this chance. We have to shoehorn it in here. We have to get this done in 2 weeks. You know, whatever. So if somebody did a good script, or if it was a situation within a, you know, on Generations, the original series cast rebelled about being in an opening scene only to set up the Next Generation, and nobody would do it, and they wound up with just Shatner doing it. They wound up with just, you know, Chekhov and Scotty and Kirk, because they thought, no, we had a fitting goodbye in 6. Why do you want to go muck with that? And, you know, oh, one more. But Nemesis was hardly Star Trek 6. Even as there are a lot of, you know, there's the battle of the, you know, retro analysis of maybe it wasn't so bad after all, or people defending it. But you have to admit that Nemesis was not Star Trek 6. And even if it's not, if they're not carrying, you know, they could be not carrying an entire movie. They could be a faction of one, but it could be more than that opening scene in Generations turned on the B turned out to be. So I can see a spectrum of possibilities there. And then as far as the bodies involved, okay, so Patrick just kind of laughingly said, sure, you know where Frakes and where Jonathan and Marina are. They've had that joke for ages about the Rikers in space.
Yeah, yeah.
I think if they paid him enough money, you know, Michael would come back and do Worf. I think LeVar, if they paid him, would be honored to do Geordi again. I don't think any of them have this, I'm allergic to that thing. Oh, please, it's haunted me my whole life. And the only one, Gates would do it. You know, then you get down to Brent and killing off Data to begin with.
Yeah, and, would he come back and play
where
B4?
Where is his head? Yeah, and if all the rest of them...
Literally, did, where is his head? It's on, it's on Kolaris 3, right. Larry.
I'm sorry. He would be the one. Now, here's the thing. You've had, again, people in different phases of life, of different phases of their careers. At the time of Nemesis, he was wanting to get out and do something else. He was feeling very self-conscious about aging, was the main driver. It didn't matter that all the canonistas said, but Data says he has an aging chip to age naturally with everyone around him. You know, an inheritance, I think. So, oh my God, I can't believe I pulled that one out. In his mom show, in the Data mom show. But, yeah. You know, he didn't care. He just thought it was getting too old, as he as an actor, as a person, was getting too old to put the Data makeup and the Data black hair in. That's been 13 years now. And you know what's happened? Well, we've had the anniversaries. We've had the tours where they've had their cast reunions at cons. And they've all, you know, they've had 10, 12 years to go by. And Brent's had a little bit of his existential fresh hell, you know, will anyone ever hire me again, even though he's this applauded, beloved actor and had a great Broadway career before that. And now he's done some regular gigs and had some spots and, you know, done some stuff. So I'm not trying to brain trust here. If I ever get a chance to ask him, maybe this will be coming up more and more as we go along. But I almost think that the chance of him doing something now is a lot better than it was 6, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And especially with them having done those reunion tours and appearances and those big filling, all the cast filling up a stage together. I think, I don't think it's a, it would depend on what it was and the quality of the script and were they carrying the entire thing? Were they a part of it? But then not too small a part, you know? So it all depends on the mix.
To see.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's a never say never again situation.
And I guess it would depend on Star Trek moving away from the Abramsverse and back into the prime timeline so that it made sense in the first place.
Yeah, someone would have, some really brilliant person that thinks they know how pop culture works, much less Star Trek fandom, who is not going to be concerned about, you know, or even if there's like a new thing, maybe there's a third new series of whatever it was setting in. But someone who was not going to, you know, one of these idiots that says, we don't want to confuse the audience if we're doing an Abrams movie or we're doing an all new series out there and not to do a, you know, because eventually what may happen, and hopefully a series, you'll repeat the whole thing of one by one seeing original series characters in some plot point or another, some sci-fi, you know, scenario, transporter loop or flashback or whatever it is, turning up on whatever maybe the new, you know, series of the teens or something is, or series of the 20s is. Which would be a one-off, and that'd be really easy to do, assuming it's all prime and whatever, whatever. But having them all back together again is a taller order. But I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility. And it seems like their minds might be, as a group, closer to doing that than it was 10 years ago. But Patrick's very quick to be a classy guy and say, we're not going to go out there and embarrass ourselves. You know, look at the original cast. There were some people that would sit out there and catcall by the third movie, much less later on, and say, oh, the old fogies are out there still. You know, it's like the camera angles had to be chosen and the plot and the action had to be such that, you know, and it even became a joke in 6 of Kirk with the girl and Kirk doing the action stuff. But it's like, well, he'll just do it till he dies. But, you know, it all has to be carefully chosen and supported. But, I don't think it's a never say never, and I think it's closer to happening than it, like I said, than it was a few years ago.
Huh. Well,
with all those caveats, but we'll see. Those are a lot of caveats, though. So
those are a lot, yeah. But I think that would make a lot of fans happy if it were to happen.
Oh yeah. And the biggest caveat would be somebody that's got their finger on the reins and the money purse, saying okay, or somebody coming in and pitching, and somebody with the clout, as always, somebody with the clout and the power, especially if this comes out of nowhere. If we come up with some new showrunner who instantly builds a huge TV power base and the Bad Robot contract expires and they never do anything more with it, and the new power base TV person, there's this feeling after a year or two or three or four, hopefully not too long into the future, that they're going to be given the reins to do features. And they want to, like any smart coach or teacher who comes in after a successful program and their ego is not so big that they let it get in the way and they embrace the old glory, that they're smart like a Bob Stoops instead of the three guys before him who goes back to Barry Switzer.
I knew this was Bud coming Wilkinson. Around to some sort of Oklahoma reference
well,
here,
Well, you know, if it's their use... But Saban was smart enough to do that at Alabama, right?
He was.
And you had the interim coaches after, right?
Yes,
you had the clueless
we had a
people.
Whole string of them. Yeah.
It's hard on anybody following somebody successful. So I'm just saying that if somebody who gets the TV series franchise is really smart, they will do that. And it could be one-off bits just like Next Gen did with the original series guys in their time. Or if they're really smart and they get the reins, and we're over somehow the CBS Paramount movie TV split, or it's navigated somehow by then, maybe there'll be clout to put them together by somebody who gets it and has a clue and has the ability and the clout to get it done.
And I will judge them by whether or not they make Loeffler a main character
of course you would.
On the new show. So.
Of course you would.
Well, that could be a whole hour discussion there, Chris.
That's right.
Would she come back and... Would she is she's not going to run for senator in Kentucky, is she going to save the rest of her life to save
no,
a
she's
going to
wake up one morning and go, you know, I really am Robin Loeffler and I should be doing Star Trek again. All right, well, we'll see where this goes. So Larry, let's shift gears
it's
back
certainly
to
right
the original
right
series
now.
And talk about the Tholian web.
Great.
The fabric of space is a delicate thing. If you're not careful, you could slip right through it, particularly if some trigger-happy Tholians come along. That's what happens to Captain Kirk in the classic episode The Tholian Web, and we're going to discuss this, one of Larry's favorite episodes today, with the help of someone who knows what happened to the Defiant. It's the host of our Enterprise show, Warp 5, none other than Norm Lowell. Norm, welcome to the Ready Room.
Hi, Christopher. I'm glad to be back, and I'm really glad to actually be back on mic with you again, because it's been a while.
It has been quite a while. I record very infrequently these days, unfortunately. But I'm glad that you're here, and also it's your first time, I believe, recording with Larry as well.
My honor. It is actually, I'm a huge fan. I think a lot of people in the Star Trek fandom are. So, Larry, it's actually finally great to virtually meet you. Even if I can't shake your hand, I'll shake your hand across the interwebs.
Across the interwebs to the other side of the room or whatever.
That's right.
Yeah. No, and Chris, it's good to be back with you. I know you're on the other side of the international dateline, so
might
as well be hyperspace. But it's good to see you up and around again. We were really worried there when you were so down those months. But
well, it's good to be back around. And it's good, yes, that we've gotten the moment here of the next interphase where the time zones and the dateline come together and we can cross over and record together.
Is that on the map where the datelines just bulge out?
It's, you know, exactly. Yeah, there's this big bulge right over the top, yes.
Dum, 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 dum. Dum, 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 dum.
Okay, so a quick synopsis of this episode, if you haven't seen it or haven't seen it in a while. The Enterprise encounters a mysterious Constitution-class starship, which of course turns out to be the Defiant. And as they go aboard, they find out that the crew is dead. In fact, when asked what the cause of death might be, Bones reports that the cause of death is them killing each other. Well, Kirk gets left over aboard the Defiant, and they spend the rest of the episode trying not to go mad aboard the Enterprise while trying to get Kirk back. Of course, things can't be that simple, so the Tholians show up and try to spin a web around the disabled Enterprise. But in the end, thanks in part to Uhura's mirror in her quarters, they are able to get Kirk back and save the day. And we do end with a somewhat haha ending, which is very common on the original series with Kirk, Spock, and Bones. So, Larry, I have to start out by just asking you, because I know that this is one of your favorite episodes. It's one that you were asking if we had done before. So why is the Tholian Web a special episode for you?
Well, it's just a good episode. It's very cool. It has another ship. You have the environmental suits. I'm going back to your implications when you're first watching the show for the first one or two or three or four or five or six times. And I'm talking about when you're waiting on it to come around in syndication cycle, because of course that's how else you're going to see a Star Trek show, unless you had it recorded on your cassette tape from your TV speaker.
I used to do that.
But yeah, wow. But no, I mean, you know, I have, you know, everybody has their favorite shows, their top five, their top 10, especially the original series, or I guess they do. And this was one of mine. And before we were so drenched in behind the scenes awareness and knowledge and all of that, you just knew that some of the shows were early shows. I mean, if you're really smart, you would watch the stardates, you know, increase slowly. But you knew that Corbin might maneuver, and ooh, Uhura's in a gold dress, and you know, and the uniforms hung different ways, and you knew that you could hear them not dub the doors, or they'd have a door over a line and they couldn't put the sound in, so it would just scrunch when a turbo lift would open. You know, those kinds of things. And then it kind of hits its stride. And then you see Scotty comb his hair back, and you see everything brightly lit without the color gashes on the walls, and the uniforms change once again to the double knit stretch, and through all of that you can kind of get the curve of the general maturation of the series. And most of my favorites tended to be from the second season, because I thought that was kind of the maturity of the show. And now I know it was when Gene Kuhn was such an influence, and it was really partly the reason why. But third season are the ones you kind of go, I didn't realize the time that there was that really devout, loud Spock faction for a long time in fandom that said, we don't accept the third season because they raped the Spock character, and he would never do that with Droxine, and he would never talk that way with the Romulan commander and all that. So after the first few waves of awareness set in, I knew that, you know, even then, third season, well, I loved Tholian Web, and I liked Enterprise Incident, the Spock purist be damned or whatever. And not so many shows in the later year than earlier. But this was one of them. Like I said, it had so many cool elements. And now I look back and know that this was that burst at the beginning of the year when, even though Gene had left and Freiberger was running the show and all that, that there was, it was almost like the momentum from second season, even though Gene Kuhn had left and John Meredith Lucas was running, and then I guess Arthur Singer came in the third season and Gene had stepped back. It was almost like some of the momentum carried over, because Bob Justman was still there and they got their budgets cut again. Matt Jeffries was crying more and more, but they were finding ways to put the shows out, and Gene Kuhn was writing, but he was under his pseudonym. So it's almost like there was a little bit of carryover from the second season, and Tholian Web is clearly, you can tell, in that little batch of shows before the bottom kind of fell out mid-season. And like I said, all that, I know that now intellectually, but at the time, I didn't. But I just intrinsically felt that. And those are all the reasons why. And it was a good, and of course, it has a great McCoy, is actually part of the triad. And everybody gets a role. Uhura has a bit. Scotty has a bit.
Well, it's one of the few episodes where all of the main cast are there in the same episode, because usually there's somebody missing more often than not.
Well, they finished filming Green Berets, so George was back in as Sulu, so, you know.
Well, Norm, what about you? This is a third season episode. It's the ninth episode of the third season. And are you a fan who feels how the third season dropped in terms of production? And you're not one of those who says the third season isn't canon, are you?
Well, no. I mean, when I first started watching Star Trek, and the total experience of me watching Star Trek, it was with the original series. Actually, that's not accurate. It was with the animated series and then the original series as it became syndicated.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Because I'm in that age pocket.
Yeah.
So when I first started watching it, again, I agree with Larry. There's this really cool factor when you see another starship. especially off in the distance, and they're going to study it, and they're like, why is it out there? We're going to start linking up with our Constitution class brothers and all of the different, you know, all the different crew, you know, the crews and all that kind of stuff. And then for some odd reason, there's trouble with the ship. There's trouble with the crew. You saw it in the Immunity Syndrome. You saw it in
Omega
the Doomsday Machine.
Yeah,
Omega Glory.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's mind-boggling that you never actually get to see two crews get to work together side by side.
A functioning other starship. What a concept.
Yeah. With this, I mean, this is the Federation, you know, so it's like all of a sudden, you know, we'll just join up with the Defiant in this deep space part of their mission. But no, the Defiant is it's suffering from interphasic space. The crew is, I love that. When Bones addresses why the captain died, he died from a broken neck. That's genius. The medical scanners are on point in this episode. But I'm digressing way too much. But I know I love this episode. I don't really compare it to a digression of second season to third season. I mean, you do know there are telltale signs if you've watched the original series over and over and over again. There's almost kind of like a filter that's on the first season. There's a lot of brightness, a lot of newness to it. The second season, you're right, Larry, it has a lot of maturity to it. You can feel that the cast and the crew and the scripts are gelling. There aren't any real soapbox moments with any particular character. Well, there are with the triad, of course. But in the third season, they're starting to take a little bit more risk, maybe because the scripts just really aren't here and there. There's a lot of...
When you say risk, do you mean writing risk, acting risk, actor's risk? What do you mean by risk?
I think there's a little bit more writing risk, like just these pocket stories, like Spectre of the Gun, or... Again, like this story, this is like a ghost story. It doesn't really have to fall into the continuity of it. But this is serialized TV. Continuity wasn't really like a key factor when it was being written. Unless you see like, you know, Rand go from episode to episode to episode to gone. I mean, that's kind of like a continuity thing.
Right.
And yet so, Janice Lester mentions this episode in Turnabout Intruder, one of the moments of semi-continuity in TOS.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. But I like it because... You can sit down, you can get into it, and unless you're paying to some of the stock footage of horror that they pulled every time she turned around and talked about hailing frequencies, because I think that her wig changed at least three times. and the lighting did change on her a little bit, because sometimes it's a little bit high glare, sometimes it's very flat.
Yeah.
You know, you can see, again, with repeated viewings, you can see a little bit of, you know, the flaws here and there, but for the most part, it's a lot of fun, because... It's serious, it's goofy, it does actually show a lot of the crew. They all get their moments, which is nice if you're a fan of watching the entire crew and you're not having a Kirk versus Spock versus McCoy fandom war as you're watching it. So I don't begrudge the third season, you know, as some fans might.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the Defiant itself. And they were originally going to call this ship the USS Scimitar. I'm very glad they didn't, because then things would have been spoiled for Nemesis, and what would Shinzon have done for his ship? So instead, they named it the Defiant, which means that very often when you're talking about Star Trek and you mention the Defiant, you have to clarify whether you mean this one or Sisko's little ship. So good job there, guys, on naming the ship. But as you mentioned, we do see another Constitution-class ship here, and unfortunately... As we were discussing on the other side of the room, every time you board one of these ships, you find out that everyone's dead. So if you're in the academy and you graduate and you get assigned to... At this point in time, we really don't see other types of ships. So you better just hope it's the Enterprise, or else you know you're probably not going to survive your tour of duty.
Well, it's Anthony says about going to our sister ship. I almost got this image of, oh, look, it's a Filbert class ship. Yeah, but they're smaller than us. We're not going to mess with them. We have to go. We can only deal with, it's only like sibling to sibling or something. Uh-huh. But no, it's like no wonder the Enterprise patch was adopted by Starfleet. It's the only one they could find a record of after five or six years.
Right.
I mean, could you imagine Starfleet Command handing out the commissions like, oh, he's going to wear the red shirt and go on that other ship? We'll just check him off right now.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, you've got your lucky shirt when you're watching a football game and your team won when you were wearing it. So now you have to wear it every time. That's also the Enterprise insignia. That's the insignia of the only ship whose crew didn't die.
Yeah.
So
just wear
it
on the right color shirt. That's all.
That's right.
You know,
you're going to need to use that one.
And you know what? Now that I'm thinking about it, we're not thinking about Ultimate Computer, where only one out of four Constitution ships was bashed over the head. Yeah. Right. Can we back up just a minute and talk about the roots of Tholian Web? Here's something that kind of gets overlooked unless you're like one of the two or three feminist Star Trek writers I know that are out there. Bob Justman bought the... Judy Burns was the writer of the Tholian Web, and she had a writing partner, Chet Richards. But Bob was actually trying to find new... He was trying to do his own one-man kind of diversity campaign there on Star Trek. That's one thing that the third season does have. And then at the end, there was that spate of shows right at the end that were all first-time women writers that made their sales. But yeah, the ship is named Scimitar. It's not about rescuing Kirk. Chekhov tells Spock that they should fly the Enterprise into the other dimension to rescue Kirk.
I can hear him saying that.
Yeah, and then he not only rescues, but Kirk reasons with the Tholians in the other dimension to make peace. And anyway, they just thought they were going to get huge. But they all had, one of the hallmarks of all the versions was really good character interplay for all the characters, really good Spock McCoy scenes. And so anyway, it's interesting how they, but if you notice, one thing we haven't mentioned, this is very much a bottle show, just like Doomsday Machine is a bottle show with a sister ship. You know, Omega Glory isn't. They've got planetary sets. I mean, they're stock sets, pretty much. But they at least got all out of the, you know, out of the corridors and the rooms from whatever ship it was on. But it's a cheapy show. They probably blew their budget apparently more than they thought they were going to with the visual effects. But there you go. Having a bottle show at least allowed them to even consider spending what they spent on their scale for the visual effects.
Yeah, because at the time, these visual effects would not have been as easy to produce. But it was worth it, I guess, because they did get an Emmy nomination and a win, I believe, for special effects in this.
And just some real quick notes I did a few years ago was that of all the original series Emmy nominations from Tech to... I mean, we're used to in The Next Generation onward having a ton of Emmy nominations, but nobody ever got nominated for acting, guest or regular. The next Generation and its last year got nominated for drama series, best drama series, and didn't win. We're not used to anybody ever getting nominated for an acting award, but Leonard Nimoy did get nominated once or twice for Best Actor Emmys in the 60s and didn't win. But of their 12 nominations across the board in the three seasons, this is the only one that won for, and I think they said photographic visual effects was the way they worded it then. So this is original Star Trek's only Emmy Award winner.
So bringing that up, should we at least advise the listeners, if they're going to watch this episode, to make sure that they watch both the original series unremastered version of the special effects before they watch the remastered version Blu-rays? Because in my opinion, I love the effects of the originals. I mean, because it tells the right story, the effects were right on point, they were well balanced. I liked how the crystalline form of the Tholian ships, the original Tholian ships, matched the species quality of the mask. Everything felt that it was very synonymous in terms of the design philosophy of the Tholians. But when it came to the remastered ones, they almost took it a little too far, especially with some of the changes in the camera angles. And I never felt that it was really necessary, not with this episode, but that's just something I think the listeners should be able to gauge when they watch both.
Yeah,
no. Because of the Emmy win.
Well, I think by the time anyone's listening to one of your shows, Chris, and Norm, a Trek FM show, I think by the time someone's gotten to this level of seeking, you know, background knowledge, that you should, even if the Blu-rays were your entree to Star Trek, and if you were part of the wave, and we were all young once, in our many ways, if you were one of the people who says, well, I don't want to watch those old shows, but I'll watch them if they've, you know, got modern effects. You know, if that was your entree point or you're beyond that, watch both, because the one is cool to see what was done, but you really want to, you want to go back and see something at its own time and place and watch the originals, because that too evolved. We were talking about evolutions in the three seasons. And as much as they had their budgets cut and everybody was, you know, the studio and the network were leaning on everybody to get these things churned out in faster time, one thing that kind of did happen was Bob Justman's infamous stock library of effect shots did keep growing to the point where the third season has some really pretty shots of the ship across the saucer, different angles. And for once, instead of worrying about the nacelles, like, you know, fading out against the blue screen where you can see the planet behind it, It works here because they're fading. The Defiant's fading in and out. But there's some really cool, you know, some of the visual, in fact, it got the original director fired. We can talk about that in a minute. But there really are some visual effects. But what's notable about this show also is there is a young kid. And, you know, it's like, it's not just the 90s and the aughts where we had gee whiz kids with their digital, you know, doing stuff on a laptop and bedazzling their older generation. In 1968, a kid named Mike Miner showed up who had been doing little art pieces, and he sold them. And if you notice, suddenly, third season, there's like little tiny art pieces on the walls that aren't necessarily spacescapes. That's him. And he somehow got the ear of Bob Justman and Gene, whoever, and said, and was playing around with these. And of course, not digital. It's all photographic. But playing with mirrors and reverses and things, and said, hey guys, I could make that Tholian web thing work really cheap. And, you know, basically coming in and then the hyperspace effect and the Tholian mask. Mike Miner did all of those effects and did them fairly cheap, found a quickie way to shoot them. That's the only way they were going to afford that, you know. So by cutting back on the bottle show part of the physical show and splurging on their scale, we've got some memorable things. So, A, yes, people should go back and watch the original and know that in mind. But also know that Mike Miner this was his start. He worked on, you know, he kind of got in at the end here where the show was canceled and he couldn't really hang around a lot and they could buy some things from him as a freelancer. But then he came back on the motion picture. And then really on Wrath of Khan, he did a lot of artwork. He was like the number two art illustrator, producer guy, did a lot of work, especially on the escape pods and the sand plant, the original, you know, garden spot set with the blowing sand and all that. And soon after that, it was the 80s, and he was gay and contracted AIDS and died, you know, way too young. So he wasn't around to fully partake in the Trek universe. And by the time Next Generation came around, he probably would have been a big player in production and in the art department. But he was, you know, taken before his time. But anyway, but it's cool that we're talking about visual effects here. If you're looking at the long arc of Star Trek, this was where Mike Miner was kind of discovered and came in and kind of, you know, was a whiz kid that could do these things in that time, found a way to do things quick and cheap and that they could afford, and we benefit from it.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Wrath of Khan there, because as you were saying that, I was remembering that in this episode, Chekhov has that moment where he screams in agony.
Now wait, which episode?
Perfect setup for what he had to do later in The Wrath of Khan.
Exactly.
Good. Oh, that's the thing. It's got all your bullet points. It has a Chekhov scream. It's got everything. Yeah.
It does.
I was watching this with my girlfriend last night and she goes, which episode is this? I'm like, this is the one where Chekhov screams. She's like, oh.
Oh, that one.
Oh, that one.
But yeah, I agree too.
Keep bringing her along to recognize that sarcasm.
I agree too, Norm, that watch both of these. But in terms of the effects here, I'm sort of mixed on it, where I think that the web itself and the shot of the Enterprise behind the web, I like the remastered one just because I can feel more what would actually be happening, like if you're out there in space and you were looking at this web being put around the ship. But there's the point where Spock orders them to fire on the Tholian ship. That remastered effect where the phaser beams hit the Tholian ship and then it rocks backwards, it looks like a video game scene or something. It does not fit Star Trek very well. So I think some of them enhance it here, and I think some of them definitely are better off being left as they were originally.
Well, I was going to say one thing that our modern eye, that the original suffers a little bit, was the very fact that he was able to come in, and I said whiz kid this, but still, they're very two-dimensional. And it's just like, it's the depth is one plate to another plate. And the remastered guys were able to give some depth and give the, you know, the way, because one of the things you come away with is, well, how's that ship in? But it's like, it looks like it's paper thin and the ship is, you know, like it's a really bad effect from Roger Rabbit here, where it's like the paper and the steamroller just ran over the Defiant and it's really just a piece of paper between two. But in the remastered, you do get the feeling of the depth and that the field has depth. And you don't think, our modern eye watching the original effects, that it's, oh, he's just got one plate laid over another plate and they've slightly offset them. So, you know, so the web triangles and diamonds don't line up exactly on top of each other. And there's a little bit of depth there to cheat. But still, I mean, if you're able to jump and have the context, it is amazing that they were able to do this on a TV budget in the 60s.
So one other interesting point here about the Defiant is that, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Norm is someone who knows what happened to the Defiant as host of our Enterprise show. We find out in In a Mirror Darkly that it not only crossed over into another universe, as Spock describes here in the Tholian Web, but it also went back a century. But Larry, I understand that wasn't the original plan. Having this be a sequel, having In a Mirror Darkly be a sequel to the Tholian Web and a prequel to Mirror Mirror wasn't the original idea.
Well, right. And again, this was a fanboy turned loose with a professional license. Mike Sussman on Enterprise, by that time a staff writer, and he was technically at the time paired up with Phyllis Strong. They were a writing team. And he and Fred Decker and Chris Black, in the first season, he came up with this idea. But the episode that became Future Tense, maybe we know it best from the whole thing of the mysterious future craft. And they have and Archer and I think Reed are inside, and they say, wow, it's bigger on the inside than the outside. And everybody goes, oh, it's a little TARDIS joke for Doctor Who.
Right.
But the original thing out of the gate was Mike thought it would be cool. He originally tried to retcon Tholian Web with that episode, not In a Mirror Darkly, and have that be the thing they're all fighting over and struggling around and crawling over like ants because it popped up out of time, was the Defiant. That the future, the Tholians of Kirk's time had engineered the interface to send that ship, to send the Kirk-era Defiant back 100 years so that their predecessors could retcon it and retro-engineer it and have a century-advanced technology to use against Earth and all the little, baby planets that were running around at the time. A little bit like the Borg trying to go back in time in First Contact to, using time travel or whatever. Maybe if the temporal war had ever been done right, Cold War had ever been done right to deal with it. So they had that idea, but the gist of it was, aside from thinking they were waiting too late to jump into R&D, the ship and the design and all that, it was mid-season. Brannon saying, and here's something where Brannon was really right on, saying, do you really want to have the image? That would be cool, but do you want to have Archer walking around on Kirk's Enterprise already in the second season? So they, okay, and they kind of, they still kept the Tholians in there and teased people that you'd see it, right, but not. But the whole big wallop with the tie into Tholian Web was held back, and he just kept it germinating until they could stick it in. And part of it was, oh, well, God, we've got Manny running things, A, and B, we're going down in flames anyway. We might as well go down gloriously. So So they shot the wad, and the outcome that we all know now, In a Mirror Darkly, was there. But he'd had that percolating. It was a great idea, and he'd been hot to trot to do that for a couple of years.
Yeah, but I think Brannon was right that if in the second season, I think many of the fans who had still stuck around would have said, okay, that's too much.
Or too early.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean, yeah.
And it was kind of maddening that they didn't show them, that they made you wait. And then that's another thing. The one of the mysteries of Tholian Web was, for years, fans saw the mask that was used for Loskeen, and it was a very simple mask, but it was like, are those heat waves going over, which I think the script indicates they are, but people, it's angular faces, so, and you were talking about Norm tying in with the ship design was the original idea there, but it's like, are they crystal? Was that a mask? Or are they themselves crystalline? You know, how alien was that? That was one thing the third season did. They tried to, between the Melkoshian head, the Tholian mask, they were really trying, the Zatars, they were really trying to get away from, just slightly different colored tattooed design humanoids. But
although in dialogue, Loskeen here is still very much like, oh yes, we understand, in the interest of intergalactic peace, we will wait an hour and 53 minutes to see if your ship comes back.
Of your time. Yeah, well, then there's the bit of Spock and his, the renowned Tholian punctuality.
Yeah, right.
Well, if it's first contact, how do they know that? Yeah.
Now, Larry, I don't know if you've looked closely at the show notes today, but speaking of Loskeen and his mask, do you know who was playing Loskeen, the actual image of Loskeen? It was, of course, Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
I bet you didn't recognize him, did you?
Jeez, damn, no. That's what I get for not reading the memos, Chris. I'm sorry.
He's everywhere. Jeffrey Combs is everywhere.
He's everywhere. Yes.
Yeah. No, but I agree with holding back that particular part of getting an original series ship, an original series design in the second season, because I think they were still trying to establish a foothold of what they were trying to do,
right?
Let alone confusing the rest of the audience with a temporal Cold War. So it's almost kind of like the fans would have felt like they're giving into pressure because they're like, you know, Enterprise isn't doing that well.
Right.
Let's get something that really resonates with the fans. And that's obviously, even if it wasn't the Enterprise, it's obviously an original series ship, original series design, original right. series costumes.
Right.
It would have just been too much of a, I think it would have been too much of a retreat in a way if in not telling their story, even though the temporal Cold War really wasn't going anywhere at the time. So, but I think it would have been more interesting to send back a Tholian ship than a Federation ship if they're going to arm the Tholians. At least it's kind of like technology. It's like sending a camcorder back, you know, to the 60s, and they can reverse engineer it because there are still certain electrodes and stuff like that that they would have been mm-hmm. familiar with from their mm-hmm. time stream, as opposed to direct trying to like break down a Federation starship.
Or like sending a time ship from the 27th century back to today's Silicon Valley and seeing who could pick up the pieces and how much it would do for ratings in sweeps month.
There you go.
Yeah. But the thing that is kind of interesting out of this show is this was the only time we saw the Tholians. There was a mass to represent them. They were intriguing. They weren't, you know, they weren't humongoloid. They weren't in the Klingon, Romulan, Vulcan realm or you know, some more. But by the time things like, you know, the first role-play games and the first ship-to-ship, like Starfleet battles were coming out in the 80s, and the movies weren't seriously concerning themselves with a lot of, they were more about the characters than they were about doing any fanboy service to canon,
yeah.
much as some of us were trying to scream otherwise. You know, but like Starfleet Battles used the Tholians as a major ship. And so you've got all the non-canon, you know, just for the game's sake, game playing sake. But it shows that the Tholians were one of those races that was a major intrigue, like the Orions and some of the lesser, the Andorians and Tellarites and whatever. But they were an intriguing bit that we only had a glimpse of for years and years and years and years and years. And even all the way through, you know, the original Don't Repeat original series of the original Next Generation mission to... you know, Rick Berman not liking antennas on aliens because it looks like 50s bug-eyed monsters for some reason, so no Andorians and, you know, Tellarites pig noses and all that. And then they come back around to Enterprise and, okay, we'll try Orions, okay, we'll try Andorians. But part of it was just the dauntingness of when you've got fans out there going, what were the Tholians really? The poor guys on the show, you know, the production people were like, what do we do with this? What the hell do we do with this? Do we make them see, you know, you didn't have a CG option the first 10 or 15 years. By Enterprise's time, you did in a practical way, affordable right. way. Mm-hmm. But it's like, what do we do with them? Do we put a guy in a suit? Do we have another mask on a screen? Is that a cheat? Can we show them being mobile, which would be so cool? And part of the tease of Future Tense was it's almost like teasing Klingons in Trials and Tribulations. You know, it's like we got close, but then we backed off. So even that CG Tholian that they did, it's a little bit like the Gorn that they did on Enterprise. Some people, it's like, well, it's interesting, not totally happy. They had a motion capture. One of the regular extras did a motion capture Tholian, and then they, you know, CG, not to go stay on Enterprise here forever, but they did make an attempt to finally show us an actual Tholian.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I was much happier with the Tholian they showed us than the Gorn. The Gorn I was mm-hmm. very displeased with.
Yeah. Yeah. So my point is that the Tholians have been so intriguing for so long. Just one of the things that we got such a little bit of them out of here, out of this episode, but that they've stuck with us for so long.
Oh, right.
It took like
yeah, exactly.
the next to last, almost the next to last show of the last series before we ever got. Although Ron and Ira and the guys on DS9 were always throwing out, right? They're always, oh, the Tholian ambassadors.
Oh, they're
here.
Mentioning
oh,
them. Yeah, Tholian silk.
Tholian silk.
Of course,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah,
exactly.
So it shows you that that's another barometer of they were always on our mind. We just didn't get to see them.
That's a good name for the title.
If Matthew Tholians were here, he would start singing right now.
You were Tholians on my mind. Yeah,
exactly.
Or something, I don't know.
Let's talk about a really big part of this episode, which is Spock in command. This is one of those episodes mm-hmm. where we get to see Spock in the captain's chair. Now, I'm one of the people who feels that Vulcans don't make good starship captains. I'm curious to know what you guys think about that.
Intrepid.
Galileo 7.
Exactly. Well, the Galileo 7 is yeah. you know, one of the early ones. And also, I want to talk about Spock versus McCoy and McCoy's implication that Spock wants Kirk dead so that he can get the captaincy, which struck me as being very odd because Spock doesn't do anything in the series to suggest that his goal is to become the captain of a starship. But again, as we discussed on the other side of the room, briefly, maybe that was a bit of McCoy being under the influence of this space madness.
I have maybe always contended that that was space madness coming madness. In there. Yeah.
And I found this very, very off when it comes to McCoy as a character, like in the entirety of all of the episodes. It's just because he became so irrational so quickly. And we all know that they've served in the canon, they've served together for years. And McCoy has seen Spock at his best and Spock at his worst and everywhere in between. And all of a sudden, something tragic happens to the captain again, where they put Spock and McCoy at odds. And McCoy just really gives them both barrels kind of out of nowhere. And this is like even before
late in the series,
the interphasic
as well.
Yeah, and late in the series, right. And it's like the interphasic space isn't really kind of like working on. It's not like as quickly as the water did in the Naked Time or Naked Now. Yeah. I can't remember.
Naked Time. Yeah.
You know, so
Naked
so
One.
So McCoy just really just kind of, he just lets loose. And Spock really didn't do anything command decision-wise to deserve that. Of course, yeah. I mean, maybe McCoy said, "Oh, I don't agree with your decision to kind of lock horns with a Tholian so early." But Spock said, "Logically, I had to do this because this is my time window." And McCoy's like, "How dare you? You planned all this to kill the captain."
Exactly. Well, wow. Norm, if we're talking about Vulcans and command decisions here, Spock used the phasers. He got the ship disabled. It's not like he actually used his ship to ram another ship and rip a warp nacelle off of it, as T'Pol did when she was in command.
Well, these are that was Vulcans in early command. This is now Vulcans in seasoned command because, you know, you read the logs. Yes, the Intrepid didn't fare so well. We're going to stay away from those command
That's
decisions.
Right.
Could you imagine the conversation between a Vulcan captain and a Vulcan science officer who's first in command or second in command and that kind of conversation? The logic war would have been astronomical.
The logic war.
To the point
that's why it's an all Vulcan ship, because any humans on the bridge crew are like sticking their, you know, needles in their eyes out of sheer pain after a 5-minute conversation.
Actually, just reverse that dynamic and have the entire Vulcan crew and the science officer and second in command as a human. That would have been amazing. We should have seen that show.
Well, no, that moment that always did jump out. Of course, we had the same kind of thing in Day of the Dove later on, but it was happening to every same kind of thing. Space madness.
Yeah, right.
I hope people are fans of the Jetsons out there, because I'm ripping off space magic when I do that. So that's what that is. Space magic. But yeah, it does go there, and he does take it back later. I jump back and forth, and sometimes we get snarky and we make fun of it. But there's the canon. There's the in universe. What's going on? What the hell's up with McCoy? And then there's the pullback and go, oh, well, look, the writing staff died that week and they handed this out to ostriches on the street to write this script. And so it's, you know, it's like some reason like that.
Who don't know anything
I don't know
about
where
the
that
characters.
Came from, Chris. That just totally.
And by the way, ostriches hate Spock. So
it's the week the ostriches.
Oh,
wrote
man.
The show.
This episode is written by space ostriches.
Yeah, yeah. Take your peacock and shove it. We're going to the Ostrich Network. I have no idea where that came from. No, but my point is, which is another wrinkle to bring up to this, which will kind of maybe unite some of these. The I don't have the exact breakdown on the shooting order here of scenes, but I do know that the first scene shot, and it makes sense because they shot, it was a bottle show, but they did have things on the Defiant, and they would dress things a little bit differently, you know, to show a little bit of differentiation, but not a whole lot. And then have all the dead crew laying around and a little bit of disheveledness with the sets. But they shot all the Defiant scenes first, which also means that all of the, you know, hand, you know, the interphasic effects like McCoy's hand through the desktop and people walking through walls and finding those odd moments, you know, for little music stings, that was shot first and those things had to be set up. And Herb Wallerstein is listed as the director for this show, although there's no director title credit in the credits, which is weird. Mm-hmm. It was like controversial, so they just like totally backed away. No, no one at all directed this.
It just happened.
I don't know. Thank God that Mike Minor kid sold us those effects and directed the show too.
We all wandered onto the sound stages, and a couple of days later, this happened.
The director credits were swallowed by Interphasic Space.
Yeah, but seasoned veteran, a veteran of many great shows. Ralph Senensky started to direct this show, and between the effects setups taking way longer than anybody had planned on, they had like a day shooting for day and a half of the Defiant scenes turned into 3 days. They were basically 3 days behind schedule. Mm-hmm. They were also waiting on, and we haven't talked about the environmental, the spacesuits.
Oh yes, you know, I do want to talk about.
We haven't
those
even done that, but just real quickly, they were so, you know, they were like the little old ladies that were non-union that were throwing costumes over the transom because they could charge them off the budget. Whoever was making those, they were making them one at a time, and they were like, they'd get Kirk's done, and then they would get McCoy's done, and they would get, you know, and like Chekhov's was the last one. So the scenes were almost shot, not with respect to the stage, the set they were in, but I think the beaming scene was done last because that was like they finally got, like, Chekhov's was last priority, and, you know, they didn't get to do that scene till the end. But my point is, with all these delays, they fired Ralph Senensky for Fred Freiberger. They fired Ralph for being 3 days behind, which he was, like, totally gobsmacked because he had done some great shows in the past. He was, like, sixth or seventh time. He's one of the most prolific, like, third or fourth most prolific original series director. So there was upheaval in this show. And that might have affected the rewrites. The third, this is the ninth show aired or produced. But anyway, early in,
yeah.
Some of this chaos, produced, the budget cuts settling in. Yeah, I'm just saying that I think the budget cuts settling in, the chaos of changing directors and having that tension, being behind, which was a tension of its own, may have affected, and maybe some of the maybe last minute rewrites, or maybe D or anyone else standing up and saying, "Gee, this is kind of, can we like get the dramatic plot point across without having it be so on edge?" I think some of that may, the time for that and the ability to do those kinds of things may have gone out the window with all the other chaos going on in the production. Mm. So I'm just submitted for your approval, you know, okay, consideration, whatever.
Speaking of the spacesuits, so the Starfleet uniforms, they don't have the names of the officers on the uniforms anywhere, but these spacesuits have this giant bracket on the helmet with the names. And were those put on there just as a way for the actors to find the ones that had been tailored to them, or for the production people to figure out which ones they had finished?
I thought that was really funny because those reminded me of when I was playing Little League football. And the coach would come over with a giant swath of tape, write your name on it just to make sure that who you're talking to, you know who you're talking to when it comes to, you know, yelling out plays. And it's strange because it's literally like right there, like right underneath their chin. That's where the communicator should have been at least.
I'm going to say that was a practical thing for, although they were pretty standard. I mean, the suits would have been tailored, then the head would have just sat on your head. I mean, the helmet would have just been on your head.
So I think it was labeling the suit, not the helmet.
Yeah, I think it was labeling, but I also think it was for the benefit. I think it's like having a name on the back of a jersey on football, you know, or an esports team.
Yeah.
When the camera is, stupid is though that unless, you know, like the camera is like 6 inches away, it's such low relief. It's not like it's this like tombstone etched with a half inch, you know, engraving depth.
Yeah,
it's not. It doesn't really read until you're like right up on it. So it's not.
And
like
then it really reads. Camera. It's like the only thing your eye can focus on is this giant name on your helmet. Also, looking at these spacesuits, I feel like this is a point where Starfleet learned their lesson from the Naked Time, where they learned that if you're going to beam down somewhere, you need some spacesuits that, you know, don't have openings all over them where things can get up into your helmet. And they maybe overdid it a little bit with the design of these suits.
You think they learned from Naked Now? How about like NASA 1958? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, just in case you don't want to depressurize for a second, you know, or wipe your nose.
Right, right.
You know,
yeah.
Or get affected by like the poly water, you know, intoxication molecule. So
those gloves are attached tight.
Yes.
No idiot can take those damn gloves off. Yeah.
Joe Tormelin, he was a special case. You know, he knew what he was doing.
He was a specialist for nothing. Yeah.
I also noticed, though, on the front of the helmets here, is that just like a bug net that's protecting them from toxins in the alien environment?
It was the most sophisticated filtering device that Phlox ever left behind after he left the medical academy. So.
It was. Yeah. It's like, you know how the bridge controls are unlabeled, which is a sign of how sophisticated they are because they look so incredibly simple.
You don't need labels.
Right.
You know what you're doing.
Right. Because when I look at the bridge in the TOS era Constitution class starship, I immediately think, you know, it's so simple. It's very obvious what I'm supposed to do here. And that's why when aliens come to the ship, they always know exactly what to press, because you really don't even need a primer for this.
Exactly. No, I like the design of the suits. I mean, I think they were neat. And going back to Enterprise, because I usually do, it's neat to see where they had to constrain themselves with their environmental suits, because I guess the Silver Lame really is a sign of the future.
At that point, yeah.
It really looks good on camera, and it gets that nice kind of glitter effect, and that's very futuristic. Now, but I know what they're... It was neat because seeing that in the third season, knowing where the third season kind of had its shortcomings, especially with some of its financial issues, it was neat to see something that was new. I mean, it was really... It was visually new to the audience, and you're like, wow, it's like the budget constraints really didn't hit this particular episode, and maybe they blew all of this instead of putting like actual buildings up in Spectre of the Gun. But you know, or actual
walls.
Guns.
Yeah.
But at least Spectre of the Gun, they made use of that. It was a Twilight Zone feeling,
yeah. Right?
Yeah, and they were able. Yeah. Poor Matt was able to use something with it. No, that's my point about. It's like the impetus of the second season carried over, that maturity carried over in different aspects, and they actually. You know, it was still part of the AMT deal, but they got to pay for a Klingon model, a Klingon ship model, and these environmental suits. And there's a couple of like sets, like the decompression chamber in sick bay, and there's like a set and like a new that new console that turns up everywhere. That's the half crescent console. It's a control unit for Elba 2. It's got the cloaking device on it from Enterprise Incidents, that console. And there's this flat one that's got a red countertop on it that's got a Z-leg that you see in sickbay and a couple other things sometimes. But it's like you can see, but even that, it's like the first third or the first fourth of the season goes by and then everything dries up and it's just, okay, now recycle that stuff. But it's almost like that first little, it's like the high water mark of the high point of Trek production, and then about a third of the way into the third season just starts ebbing away, you know? Before we leave the environmental suits completely, the spacesuits from Tholian Web, we're talking about recycling things and getting their investment out of things. Mm-hmm. They did reuse these once, but only once. Anybody remember where they reused the spacesuits?
There was a mention of it being used in a Mork and Mindy episode.
Well, that's true, but I meant on Star Trek. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. They kind of twiddled with it a little bit.
It has to be in the third season.
Oh yeah, it was later in the third season. If I said Queen to Queens level 3.
Oh, that's right. Uh-huh. That's right. I will say Queen to Kings level 1 because that's only appropriate to say. But you're right. Yeah. Yep. And you actually just did mention Elba 2 because with the psychoanalysis unit, because that's what they threw Garth in at the end.
Right. Okay. I was talking about the console. No, the two guys that took Marta out on the surface.
Right.
Are wearing the spacesuits, which makes total sense.
Before that grain of explosive took out our lovely Yvonne Craig. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good stuff. Yeah, that's fantastic.
So they got one more use out of them, even if for a couple of seconds.
And blew the entire Series 3 budget with that second use. So.
Oh, well.
Let me ask you one thing here, Larry, with this episode. Norm and I were talking about this, and I watched it again very carefully before recording, but I also had it playing this past week as I was doing other things. And I felt that this is one of those episodes where you really have to pay attention, especially early on, or you get completely lost as to what's going on with Kirk and him being lost and why he's gone and why they're looking for him. Because there's a lot of very quiet moments in this episode, especially when they're cutting back and forth between Kirk on the Defiant Bridge when they're trying to beam him over. and then they're back over working on the transporters on the Enterprise, and they cut back and it's very quiet again. So if you're not paying attention, it's not quite clear. And then also one thing you'll miss there
you mean he's not just on a ship, that he's already been lost to hyperspace. And
yeah, the point at which he's lost is sort of hard to follow. And also what you would miss there is
it's almost like they had more than one director doing the show, Chris.
It's like nothing we've
ever seen. It's almost as if it were written
before.
By space ostriches, Larry.
Every time someone says, the readings are off the scale, Captain, I always wanted to say, get a bigger scale! Okay, anyway.
But no, the point when they put... What does Spock say? He tells Scotty to put ship energy to maximum capacity, something along those lines. And then they just vanish out of the Tholian web, and then they're somewhere else. But Kirk is still with them again. And of course, it all goes back to the fact that he was in the transporter beam at the beginning, and they couldn't pull him back over, but it created a tether where they're hooked together. And that's why Kirk is still appearing on the bridge and in Uhura's quarters and elsewhere. It's very subtle, though, I feel, if you're not really paying attention to the story.
Okay, Chris. Well, you know, when I was 18 months old, I seemed to follow the story just fine. I don't know what your problem was.
Well, that's why you're Dr. Trek, Larry.
That's interesting. Now I want to go watch it again just with that in mind. But no,
and again, I say that not if you're watching it, but if you're just kind of passively, you know how often as Star Trek fans, we just have Star Trek playing while we're working or doing other things because we've watched Star Trek so often. If you just
well,
have
that's
it going
your problem,
on the side,
Chris. That's your sin of not paying 100% attention all day, all the time your track on your screen.
Well,
occur to me. What is it? The next phase on Next Generation when Geordi and Ro think they're you have some of the same kind of the same kind of vibe. You know, that stupid Next Generation show. They never had an original idea. Okay.
And Vanishing Point on Enterprise, Larry. And we're going to bring Enterprise up as many times as possible today.
Well, okay. Yes, we should.
No, actually, it's neat because I think that's a good point because sometimes you forget, you know, kind of like that Kirk really kind of is the catalyst for almost every single thing that happens, you know, in a Star Trek episode by and large. So when you take him out of the equation, all of a sudden you come back and you're like, you know, why are Spock and McCoy at each other's throats? Or why are they in the captain's room without the captain being there? Or why is everyone doing shots at the end of the episode? You know, except for the captain.
Oh, well,
and why did Scotty get the lion's share of that beaker?
I was going to say, that's one of the all-time great scenes. I'll let you know. Does it make a good drink with scotch? Mix with scotch.
That's actually another scene that just blew my mind, and it just made me laugh out loud. Because, like, here's Scotty. I have to get ready for the next segment of interphasic space. I have to have the engines tuned just so that Spock can tell me to throw all of the power in it as much as you can. 87%. I'm going to get so hammered right now because this is the thing to do because I got to stay immune from all of this interphasic space sickness.
Ooh, a heavy,
Norm, Scotty
a
can
heavy
handle
glass
this scotch.
Beaker with orange stuff. Ooh, I'm going to take it. I just love it that it's just a simple lab beaker. Clump.
That was Federation Tang, by the way.
Exactly. Yeah. But Norm, Scotty can handle his scotch. You know, these alien toxins we don't know about. Scotch, he's got it under control. I love the fact that the antidote to this problem is diluted nerve gas mixed with alcohol.
Klingon nerve gas,
yeah.
Now, the Klingons, they know how to party because all of a sudden, if they don't have any Klingon aphrodisiac, you know, if they don't have any, you know,
just
half spoiled targ just to go, you know, sick by, they'll just, you know what, do I have any, what was it? I can't remember. It was started with a T.
Theragen.
Yeah. Or Theragen. Yeah. Derivative. Yeah. Anyone have any of that? Mix it in with a little bit of water.
Well, Norm,
now you know how they survived those pain sticks all those centuries.
That's right.
And the tribbles.
They just doped themselves. Well, that was a happy accident. Oh, God. Pass out the Theragen, Lieutenant. Yeah.
Okay. Norm, you know, all the best Klingon parties, they spike the blood wine with Theragen.
That's the secret. That's the special sauce for blood wine, you know? Instead of like oak barreled, you know, it's actually Theragen derivative.
Well, I guess I've just had my bubble popped. I always thought Ira and Ron and the guys were such big original series fans, but I don't ever remember Theragen being brought up on DS9.
Yeah, that's right. I don't think so. You would
I
think
just,
like
I want to check this, but my initial gut says no. But anyway,
maybe this is how I don't know how they got connected. How the Bajoran stayed connected with the prophets.
Oh,
they kind of atomized the derivative, okay. And it just expanded their minds.
Because I was thinking maybe Quark's cousin that deals weapons was probably trading in Theragun as well.
Well, you know, the Tholians wound up being, speaking of that wonderful classic, instant classic, Stellar Cartography, which the foundation was laid down a long time before that from everybody that worked on the show. But, you know, the Tholians were put over on on the west coast of the local known space, over on the Cardassian side. And
on the other side of the room?
On the other side of the room, yeah, on the other side of the sector. So it's you know, and then the Vanguard series used the Tholians, like running back and forth between Africa and South America. They're down there. But that made sense. Not that we know a whole lot. It's interesting that even by Next Gen and DS9 and all that time, that we don't know a lot about the Tholians, and they're kind of out there, and that they're still not totally integrated, you know, with the rest of everybody. I don't know why I went down this path. I'm
but
just trying to say that having the Tholians on the frontier, it's just been, you know, and it makes you realize that Kirk, the ship was, you know, if they were investigating the loss of the Defiant, so they had to go to that area. They weren't just bopping along singing a song and ran into this. But it's interesting that this has all evolved to put the Tholians kind of more out there than usual, and in a different direction from where all the usual, you know, not the old Romulan Klingon hangout, you know, battleground, nobody can get along space, and not even over toward the Cardassians and Bajorans, but kind of down over here in this other corner where we still don't know a whole lot about. But
I mean, coming back to saying. it was the whole thing with Kirk being not seen so much on the bridge. Larry, you might know this. It's usually when a principal actor is not actively involved with an episode of the week or an episode that you would normally see him, you know, more pronounced in. Was William Shatner doing something at that time where he would have been taken, like his duties would have been taken away, like the way that George Takei was,
right,
you know, for
right.
a couple episodes because he was doing the Green Beret?
I can tell you, like the week that Patrick Stewart hosts Saturday Night Live, he had like one scene in that week's Next Generation episode kind of thing.
Yeah, thank goodness, because right then off. He had time to do the erotic cake shop skit.
Yeah. Oh my God.
If it's not Scottish, it's crap.
Right.
So, because you know, every single episode you've seen up to this point, I mean, it's always like Kirk, Spock, McCoy, Kirk, right. Spock, McCoy, and this is really Spock, McCoy. Not a lot of Kirk in there, so.
Well, but I think it was just a necessary. If you're talking about, it almost sounds like we're having to like retcon how they approached Shatner's ego to brace him for this script. No, but I mean, he was still the catalyst of the show, even if he wasn't there.
Right. Yeah.
Bill, we need you to emote against the blue screen. We need you to emote through that sheer helmet head. Through that sheer pantyhose painted silver, we need you to emote through that. I know you can do it. You're the only one that can for a whole episode. No, I just, you know, he was, and you know, going back to the McCoy harsh speech with Spock, this is all right before they play the tape, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So part of that at all, and again, maybe it was a little more ham-handed, and maybe with less chaos, or maybe with a little more focus, or somebody, you know, more on point. They could have softened that to get the point across. But part of that was just heightening that so that his tape where he says, okay, you two are probably at each other's throats, so get along. I know you love each other, but get along better. And then they can feel
more. Yeah.
So that heightened pitch of McCoy's gives him something to come down to and feel the remorse and say, okay, well, I got a little carried away. Again,
I feel that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, but it was like McCoy's like, you've engineered this entire thing with the Tholian space to take command of the ship. You've always wanted that. Or, Spock, you really didn't make a good command decision here because the science proves that if you used a power outage, you know, blah, 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 you would have risked the ship. That's two completely different things. And I understand the ostriches were in control, so.
Okay, so one more thing in this episode. Early on, Spock says that we have to get Kirk back during the next interphase or else he'll die. When they can't get him back in that interphase, Spock starts calculating the next interphase so that they can try again.
Because Spock just never the hell gives up. Right. You know, until somebody, it's always somebody's job to not to give up so that the other main, whoever's in the scene can slap them in the face and go, you know, you've got to, you know, you've done your bit. You can't hang here forever. If it's not McCoy trying to bring somebody back, somebody does it to him. If it's not Spock being obsessed, you know, Vulcan OCD about something. No, I've got no problem with that.
No, and you're right. It's Vulcan OCD because even if he doesn't get him back alive, he has to get the captain back, period. Mm-hmm. He just has it in his mind. Like, I have to retrieve the captain because this is closure. This is what I owe him. Isn't that worth a career? You know, like, that's what, you know, he said to, you know, to McCoy. I'm digressing. So, but that's what we do on this show.
That's right.
It's all about the love. It's all about the feels.
I thought you meant it was all about
series.
The digression, but okay.
It's all about the
digression. Digression room. That's our new title.
Now, when you're digression on, gel. And when you're on the other side of the digression room, now you've gone somewhere.
I need digression gel. That's what I need. That's my problem.
Oh, man.
No digression gel in there.
No digression gel here. No, but it's...
I went to digression high. Did I ever... Okay, for all you Canadians. Okay.
Degrassi? I know. Okay. You know. Okay. Yeah, there you go. Okay. I've completely lost my point, and that's okay, because...
You're lost in hyperspace, and the ostriches are running the ship. And
that's right.
I didn't take my shot of orange tang right now.
Officially licensed Federation.
Which you retrieve from the beaker each morning, right?
That's right.
That makes a heavy thud when you put it down on the countertop. Yeah, I just
no phaser has anything on me. I can take the stun.
You know what? The other thing that's clever, and people are going to yell. We should turn this into some kind of a contest for our listeners, Chris. You know, we watch Spock. I love how they all know Kirk's room safe combination. But you know, the token stupid anal fanboy, you know, what's the combination to Kirk's safe? And people do that as a stupid, you know, anal fanboy joke, like they're still writing the 1986 Shatner skit for Saturday Night Live.
Right.
I always would come back and go, which time? Because I know you'll be shocked. It was not a consistent combination. So just to throw that out there.
Well, that's good security practice, Larry. The captain knew he should change his combination from time to time.
Without the North Koreans hacking the... Okay, yeah. Okay.
And not tell anyone in Starfleet.
Except Spock.
Just for kicks.
Except Spock.
Yeah. Yeah.
No one knows Vulcans go through Pon Farr until 2267 or whatever, 66. But everybody knows the combination to their commanding officer's safe.
Well, they change the codes every 7 years. You know, so.
Oh, that's just a myth. That's not the way it was originally intended. They can change combinations anytime they want to.
No, they have to change the combination every 7 years or else the lock will seal forever.
But they have to. Pon Farr. But they have to go back to, oh, so my metaphor was not so lightly handled, eh? Okay. They have to go back to Vulcan to change their combination.
There's only one guy on Vulcan who can change the combination to Federation locks.
Like your nerds of Earth, Captain, who change their combinations hourly.
All right. Well, we have passed an hour, so let's wrap up with our final thoughts and our rating for the episode. So, Norm, what are your final thoughts on the Tholian Web and your rating?
Oh, the Tholian Web's, it's a fantastic episode because it's fun where it needs to be. It's very serious where it needs to be. It is a bottled episode, so you get to see all of the crew in almost the stereotypical way that you usually see them. You know, Kirk is in command even when he's not on the bridge. Spock and McCoy are doing their thing. Chekhov is screaming. Uhura's fainting. Scotty's drinking. And Sulu is, you know, kind of like the support guy. He's either catching Chekhov when he's falling or giving data to Spock. It's just everyone has their role. It's a lot of fun. It's, again, it's one of those very few times where you actually see them all united as a crew. They're not going off in their different away missions. So it's fun. The Tholians are great. I still love the original effects. Obviously, they were great because they were Emmy Award-winning original effects, you know, back in 1969. And that was obviously a challenge because these were practical effects. No digital, no electronic, no any, you know, special effect. They were all practical digital effects. So I can watch this episode over and over and over again because it's fun. And it's very much in the vein of Star Trek. It has that old school 1960s flavor to it, and even more so with the Silver Lame suits, because that's what makes everything quasi-futuristic science fiction clothing, Mr. Powers, as he said. So I'm going to rate this episode 4 out of 5 shots of Theragrin Orange Tang Federation trademark derivative.
All right. No scotch in there?
Well,
I'll let you know.
I can't handle it the way Scotty can handle it. That's why he's chief of engineering, because he can drink and take care of the warp nacelles at the same time.
He's not just a miracle worker. He's a miracle drinker.
I...
All right. Larry, how about you? Any final thoughts? What's your rating?
Well, I wanted to cram in just a little bit more here because this is such a good, it's such a bottle show that you're on the ship that there's some faces you can look real quick for. So Bill Blackburn, who was D. Kelly's stand-in, and he was Lieutenant Hadley. And when I was a kid and didn't know all this, I just called him Lieutenant Gooseneck because, it was the relief navigator and all that. Uh-huh. He's the guy that the madman during Kirk's funeral, he gets attacked and he rubs his neck. That's Billy Blackburn, who then sold his home movies later on some of the DVD, Blu-ray bonus features. Kirk's stunt double, Paul Baxley, is the dead defiant captain. And Sean Morgan, who had been Ensign Harper, who was killed in Ultimate Computer by M5, he's back as Scotty's assistant while they're working. He's Lieutenant O'Neill while they're working on the transporter. So, it's his, I guess he was cloned, went to Federation Protective Services and had to change his, I don't know.
Got a new name. Yeah.
Yeah.
Section 31
yeah.
does that.
Yeah, that's, yeah, there we go. But I'm glad we were able to mention the Emmy. And of course, the Defiant that we do see is another, just like the Constellation, is another AMT model kit. But this time they didn't do the decal switch. They just kept it so far away and interphase hazy that they didn't even mess with decals on the hull. They just stuck it. And for those of you who are daring enough to watch the original effects, the Tholian cruiser turns up again as, you guys know, right? They stuck two little nacelles on it and made it the Aurora that the space hippies stole at the beginning of Way to Eden.
Oh, okay.
Which the Blu-ray remasters go in and they give them their own ship, and that's probably how it would have been. But some of the charm of cheap effects from the 60s is a little lost. So anyway,
that is the charm.
There's your bonus. But yeah, no, I just intrinsically almost got it. When you had to sit and watch the shows go by, over 3 months before they recycled back around to We're No Man, I just remember thinking that we'd hit Tholian Web and Enterprise Incident, and then after that there was kind of like this vast wasteland where you could watch them, but they just weren't the really cool ones. So maybe a couple at the end. And so, yeah, I've always liked Tholian Web. It wasn't until later that I realized it was just like one of the hallmarks of the third season. They were still battling against the wall. They were still spending a little money on some things. It wasn't until just recently that I realized the whole drama with Ralph Sininski getting fired and why and all that, which is sad and kind of unjustified. But, yeah, it's a great show. Everybody's in it. The suits are – it's like the last time there's some real – production gravitas to original series episode, and you didn't just feel like they were just hauling all the old set pieces out and old uniforms and just going at it. And the fact that Mike Sussman would bring it back on Enterprise, and that the Enterprise art guys would retcon Defiant patches since they didn't they were too cheap to do them here by that time. So for all of that, I want to give this I'm going to give it 4.5 Tholian throwing shurikens. Tholian cruisers.
Very good. All right. Well, I really enjoy this episode as well. And I've always liked the Tholians. They're like the Gorn. They're that alien that you see one time in the original series that becomes very iconic and you want to see more. And I had to talk about the Enterprise tie-in because I was really happy when, as much as I'm not a fan of those episodes of Enterprise, I really was happy to see the Defiant show up and see the Tholians again. So that was pretty cool. So I'm going to give this episode 7 bolts of Tholian silk. All right. Well, Norm, thanks for joining us today. Tell everyone before you go where they can find you here on the network and around the interwebs.
Well, it was a lot of fun to be on with you again, Chris. Again, it's been a long time. And Larry, it was a great pleasure to finally, again, virtually meet you and even learn a couple things in the episode, which is, it's always fun about classic Star Trek. You can always learn something.
Yes, you can.
Well, you can always find me here on the network as the host for Warp 5, our dedicated Enterprise show. And you can find me on the Babel Conference, our Facebook listeners page. You can also find me on Twitter at Norman Lau. That's NORMANLAO. And I'm also a proud supporter of Alec Peters and the Axanar Project. You can find me on the Axanar fan group page on Facebook. And lastly, I'm a proud supporter of Trek FM through Patreon, and I'm an associate producer for 4 shows, Warp 5, The Orb, The 602 Club, and Axanar, the official Axanar podcast.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for joining us today, Norm.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, Larry, that was a fun discussion about the Tholian web, and I'm glad that you were here with us today because you had a lot of interesting background information to add.
That was fun. I haven't gone into that much detail about an original series episode, you know, aside from Journey to Babel and Doomsday Machine, in a long time. So that was a lot of fun to get back into the swing of original series, yeah.
Yeah, enjoyed it very much. But it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
I really, really, really hope that if they do that, they make Chang the villain because, you know, Captain Chang instead of General Chang or whatever, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, that just seems like the perfect way to go.
Earl Grey.
All right, Riker, we're promoting you to captain. I mean, you killed the last captain. We usually don't reward that. That's usually not a policy, but in this case...
Well, to be fair, he had spent some time on a Klingon ship.
The Orb.
But the Federation and Bajor as a member of the Federation would be helping rebuild Cardassia. And I could see, like, very much the relationship between the U.S. and Japan today. I could see the Federation and Cardassia having that kind of relationship moving forward.
To the journey!
Janeway has a very distinct pain noise.
Yeah, she
you know
kind
what I'm
of
talking
does.
About?
It sounds sort of like she's suffocating.
Yeah, it sounds like she's suffocating and sometimes, and I'm going to keep it clean, not always in pain.
The Ready Room.
He is the best cosplayer ever because he's so buried himself in his part that we have no idea who this guy is outside of the impersonation of Tuvok.
Exactly.
He's the Christian Bale of the Delta Quadrant.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
If I'm not mistaken, in any upcoming episode of Next Generation, we don't see full-grown golden retrievers running around the decks of the Enterprise. And I'm also a little worried that Captain Picard has never played with puppies.
Commentary, Trek stars.
But you'd rather see Red in charge than him.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Right.
Because you really want porn stash to go down.
Yes, yes, you do. And that sentence out of context sounds really strange.
Literary Treks.
As great as Picard is and his Picard maneuver, I don't think Picard straightening his shirt is going to help him when he's going up against the Riker maneuver.
Fair enough, yeah.
So. Axanar, the official podcast.
The changes that we've made, the change to the nacelles and several other aspects of these ships to make them distinct and not the same ships as in Star Trek 2009.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. We're in iTunes, on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. You can go to the website and stream from that webpage. You can also download the MP3 file from there or grab the RSS link. And of course, you'll also find the Ready Room along with all of our shows in the Trek FM Complete Master Feed. Subscribe to that to get everything, all the shows on the network, including Mission Log. And you can just listen to Star Trek all day long, no matter what you're doing. While you're in iTunes, if you have a moment, please leave us a star rating and a written review. We love to hear what you think about the show, and that also helps us rise up in the search results so that other Star Trek fans can find the Ready Room as they're searching for their podcasts. I'd like to say thanks to our associate producer here on The Ready Room, Renee Roberts. You can find Renee on Twitter at @Maress_1701. That's M-R-E-S-S, just like the officer aboard the Enterprise in the animated series. Renee is a huge supporter of Trek FM. She's been with us since the very beginning, and I really, really appreciate all of her help in keeping the show coming to you guys every week. Now, if you would like to support the show and the network, you can do that through Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find milestone contribution levels as well as perks that go with those. And you can set any amount that you would like to contribute on a month-to-month basis. We are a listener-supported network, so we do need your help to keep the shows coming to you. It costs quite a lot to produce, host, and distribute our shows each week. But we have so many great patrons, so many supporters there, and we hope you'll join them as well. That's at patreon.com/trekfm. So, Larry, I know you have all kinds of stuff going on these days in the world of Star Trek. So if people want to find you and find out what you have going on, where should they go? And then tell us about a few of those things that are happening right now.
Yeah. Well, as usual, you can go to LarryNemechek.com or the old blog, TreklandBlog.com. And I've got a lot of my backlog of video interviews are going up, including a lot of Star Trek Continues bits and pieces. It was great. We just finished the Kickstarter on Star Trek Continues. And not only did we make goal, but we've made stretch goals beyond that. And the next episode 4 is going to debut with Colin Baker, who was the sixth Doctor from Who, and some other surprises. It's going to debut at Phoenix Comic Con over the Memorial Day weekend, and hope to be there. But so that's all happening. Terrace and I have already been plotting some day trips for Vegas this year with our LA to Vegas. Won't be the full tour, but some day trips at Vegas from Geek Nation Tours. And we're already plotting the 2016 full blown tour, and we're going to add a San Francisco component.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah, so we'll see the Presidio, and we'll walk in the future shoes of Starfleet Academy and Starfleet headquarters, and that beam down place where O'Brien and Kira kept trying to find them. And
are you guys going to hire
in the Bell Riots?
Are you guys going to hire a punk rocker and take everyone on a bus ride and have them blast music so that, like, you are terrorists?
Chris, I ask you not to share that.
I'm sorry, I spoiled it.
I've got some masochist and sadist Facebook groups. I was going to try to market that to. yeah. So I mean, we're already working on 2016. People are already talking about all the different angles of the 50th anniversary next year. But that's all that I have my topic. I haven't even shared it with you yet. For our Trekland on Speaker CD this year that will debut at Vegas, so a lot of that stuff. The big thing for me, a couple things, is that I've got conventions coming up, a lot of my regular haunts. But I'm doing a new thing this year. I'm making Skype guest appearances. So if it's good enough for Leonard, it's good enough for me, I guess. But I'm talking to a big fan meetup group in Dublin, February 28th, and then at the end of March. On the April 4th weekend, First Contact Day, there's a First Contact Day event in Leicester, England that I'm going to be on Skype for. And a big chunk of that, so, get your tickets for those. And a big chunk of that is my current role also as spokesman for the Enterprise and Space Project, which is not my baby per se, but I'm thrilled to be on the team for it. It's an amazing homage to Gene Roddenberry and all the inspired future-looking sci-fi made real, starting with young minds and their science experiments to be flown free of charge after they win the contest and submission on an orbiter that we just had a contest that we just announced the winner for, a designer in San Francisco who works at a game company by day, Stanley von Medvey, and we've got his design. So we're not Kickstarter or Indiegogo, but we're grassroots funding. 2 million people give $20 or more, maybe some big givers later on. And, we've talked about Enterprise in Space before, but it's moving forward. And
great.
This is the first full convention year I'll be able to go out on the circuit and talk about it. And, that and all my other projects, too. So that's really been an exciting term. Plus, I'm working totally outside the Trek realm on my voiceover work and career. So that's getting off the ground. And it's an exciting time all around.
And somehow you still find time to podcast.
Yeah. Well, I can't say no to you, Chris. I love it. I just wish sometime you'd do something like just give me some kind of a shout out for all the damn number of shows I've done. I mean, it would be nice to get some kind of recognition somehow.
You mean like if you had your own channel in iTunes or something like that, right?
Well, something like that, but that's a pipe dream. Like, when would that ever happen? That's kind of good. Let's not go crazy. I'm trying to be, simple and humble here when I ask for these things. But no, I love doing these shows. And like I said, we just did, I mentioned a while ago, we did
Literary Treks
yeah. on Michael's Faden book. And so, it's like a lot of us around here. I haven't been on as often lately, but I love coming on and talking about Tholian Web and getting to meet Norman tonight was a real hoot. So,
yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, if you would like to share your feedback on the show today, there are many ways for you to get in touch with us. You can go to our Twitter page. Our username is TrekFM. Also on Facebook, we have a group called the Babel Conference, which Norm mentioned. in the wrap-up to the feature there. The way you get there is to type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or on our website. Click Discussion up on the menu bar. Those will both take you right over there. It is a closed group because it's just for our listeners. We only promote it here on the shows on the air. So you do need to click Join and we'll let you on in. We have hundreds of members there. We have great discussions every single day and I hope you'll join us over there. You can also go to our website and use our contact form at trek.fm/contact. Fill out that form and that will come to me by email. And you can send us a voicemail if you go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. That's the word speak and the word pipe.com/trekfm. Also, one more thing here I wanted to read on the show today, Larry. We got an iTunes review from Emily Reeds, who said, "Great overall Trek podcast," and gave us 5 stars. And Emily Reeds said, "I have been listening to various Trek FM podcasts for months now and slowly making my way through the back catalog of The Ready Room. It is a really great Trek podcast. I love the variety of hosts and perspectives on the shows, and it is really nice that it rotates between all 5 series. I often find myself laughing out loud while listening, yet it still manages to also balance out with serious discussion of the episodes. I look forward to more episodes in the future." Now, Larry, she didn't say here whether she's making her way through the back catalog of the Larry Nemechek channel, but I assume she is.
Well, she's saving that for last, obviously, because it's the cherry on top.
I see. The best for last.
Right. Yeah, right, right.
All right. So I'd love to hear from all of you guys out there as well. So again, if you're on iTunes, leave us a review and let us know what you think about the show. Now, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, a letter C and Brian with a Y. You can also find me on Facebook in the Babel Conference. I keep an eye on that all the time and I try to contribute as much as I can given my schedule these days. So I'd love to talk to you there. And then elsewhere on the network, you can find me on The Orb with Matthew Rushing, where we talk only about Deep Space Nine. And you can also find me on Hyperchannel, which is Star Trek news, which I do. I've started doing it again now, a day or two a week, and I will share with you some of my thoughts on some of the news stories in the world of Star Trek, and of course ask you to go over to the Babel Conference and let me know what you think about it as well. So check out those if you want to hear more of my thoughts on the world of Star Trek. Well, Larry, I'm going to head back down to Uhura's quarters because there are some other crew members that have gone missing, and I'm thinking that that magic mirror might help me find them.
Is it the mirror that's phasing you in and out of that Therogen derivative mixed with some Tranya, maybe? I don't know.
No, I do the scotch with Scotty. It's really good.
I was going to say, hey, I stuck up for rum. You heard me there.
Rum is good, too.
You know, yeah. I wonder what diet Therogen. I wonder if there's a wang to it. I don't know. But I also wanted to point out, Chris, that I've gotten through the entire episode today and never once mentioned the Conifrat. So I just want an award for that. That's all I want to say. Otherwise, you know, I think it's time to stick a Tholian ostrich beak in it because the Ready Room is done.